Welcome to episode 55 of GBW. I would like Josh to tell you what he was just singing and annoying the shit out of me with before we started.
I don't know what the song's called.
Well, just sing a little bit for us.
I don't sing.
Well, then do it. It's not really singing.
Up in here, yeah. Up in here.
He was fucking singing DMX to me before we started.
It's been in my mind all week.
Why?
I don't know.
Why?
I don't know. Maybe I saw it in a trailer or something.
Do they still use those terrible songs in movie
Maybe
trailers?
I was watching it.
We're watching like a friggin' 90s Steven Seagal movie. Were you watching Exit Wounds?
I don't know.
Is that on your What Have We Been Watching?
No, not this week.
All right. Welcome to episode 55. This week we're trying something new. So we've been doing franchises, topics, what have you. We decided instead of doing a one-person episode, we're going to double up.
Yeah, we're going to do that up in here.
Up in here. So we're trying something new. We've picked a couple of people who we'll talk about later.
Yeah.
And
they're going to know who it is.
Yeah, well, we picked Jeffrey Combs and Barbara Crampton.
Yeah.
And it makes sense, if you know these two actors, why we paired them together.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about them. But first, let's talk about what we've been watching.
Sure.
So I'll just quickly mention the one that you talked about quite a bit at length last episode.
Okay.
And just throw in my two cents.
I sold you on it.
After we recorded, I took her home. It was Unfriended.
Yeah.
From her pals at Blumhouse. And, you know, you're kind of right. You don't hear this again. You're hearing this again. 2 weeks in a row. I'm saying you're kind of right. I actually kind of liked it. I thought it was pretty fun.
It's good, right?
It was like a decent variation on found footage movies.
I thought it was cool that they did it all in one take.
Yeah, it's like the whole movie is from the perspective of one girl's laptop.
Yeah.
So like Josh said, it's, you know, Skype conversations, Facebook posts, you know, chat roulette, all that kind of stuff. And I just thought it was a cool concept. Well done.
Yeah.
I thought that there was a few decent moments of violence throughout. But
yeah, the violence didn't really jump out at me too
much. I just found the movie a little bit silly. I was more invested in the actual story than I was in the violence.
Yeah.
And at times I felt like it was a little bit tacked on.
Yeah.
Because some of it was a little bit too over the top for what it was.
But again, and also again, if they're trying to do it in one take, they can't get too elaborate, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I actually really liked the section in the near the finale where they were playing Never Have I Ever.
Yeah, that's a good part.
I really liked that part. I thought that was really well done, and I thought it was kind of, it was kind of like tense and, you know, like digging out the dirt on everybody, and it was a pretty cool scene. It was a pretty cool sequence of events there.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was surprisingly better than I expected, so we're both going to say now that you guys should check it out.
Yeah.
So, Unfriended.
Unfriended, and I heard there's a sequel in the works.
I don't think it's necessary.
But I'd be interested in seeing this style explored again. I just don't know if they just do a retread of the same style or if they'd incorporate something different.
Are they going to hire Mike Flanagan to do it?
I hope not.
Hey, I heard Ouija 2 is supposed to be better. But we'll see. Okay.
Hey, I know he's got a huge amount of fans. So
I liked Hush. You didn't.
No.
Fair enough. Moving on. What do you got for me?
Oh, am I starting?
You got more, so you start.
I got more.
I know you got more. And here's where Josh goes, as usual.
Sleepaway Camp 2, Unhappy Campers.
Okay, okay.
From 1988. Of course, this is a sequel to last week we reviewed, Sleepaway Camp.
Yeah.
Directed by Michael A. Simpson.
Yep. Shot back to back with part 3.
Part 3.
Yep.
So, yeah, I mean, okay. So, first of all, I will say that I thought the first one was far superior to this.
You'll find me disagreeing a little bit.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people disagree, but I just had a lot more fun with the first one. I enjoyed it a lot more. I thought the story was way better.
The first one's definitely more batshit than the second one.
Well, there's that, and I just liked the whole style. Like I thought it was really colorful, the first one. I actually really liked the characters quite a bit in the first one. And this one, I just felt like everyone was just kind of fodder. So this was, this was more of a typical slasher movie, whereas the first one I felt like was set a little bit apart. And this also had a lot of comedy elements to it, which I, you know, I kind of appreciated some of them, but definitely not my genre of choice. So, you know, we find out pretty quickly what happened to the killer from the first movie. And also, this is taking place at a different camp. This is at Camp Rolling Hills, yep, as opposed to Camp Arawak. I was pretty into it when the opening credits came on, because it was like a super metal opening credit sequence with this, like, I don't know who the band was. I forgot to look it up. And also the ending credits also had a big metal song.
All the two sequels have metal songs.
Yeah, and I did notice that there was a Flotsam and Jetsam LP featured prominently in this movie, so I'm thinking maybe it was Flotsam and Jetsam.
I know, was it the song called, like, Sleep Away?
I don't. Yeah, I think it might have been.
That's some, I don't remember the dude's name. It's like John something. It's like, it's a one guy who does
it. Was
that
on, I saw the soundtrack was put out on Enigma Records, who did some really good stuff back in the 80s.
I remember Enigma.
Yeah, I think they did the Return of the Living Dead soundtrack, actually. But yeah. What was interesting in the end credits is that it didn't say who the songs were by. Hmm. Like, it said the writers of the songs,
right,
but it didn't say who they were performed by. So I forgot to check on IMDb who actually did the song. So my bad. Okay, very, very quickly, we're introduced to a character named Allie, who is by far my favorite.
Yeah.
Thanks to her.
I wonder why.
Rampant nudity.
Yeah.
So yeah, she was taking,
you know what
her,
my favorite thing about Allie is?
What?
Is when she's like, she fucks the guy in the forest. She's like, you don't have AIDS, do you?
I know.
Because she doesn't like to use condoms. And that's the first thing she does right after the dude climax. She's like, you have AIDS, do you? You're not going to give me AIDS, are you? And he's like, no. He's like, that was great, thanks. And she leaves.
I know. She gets off and leaves. But I will say that was a pretty great sex scene.
She's like the man of the movie. That's like gender reversal here, because she's the guy who screws and leaves.
Yeah. Yeah, played by Valerie Hartman, who hasn't really been in much else, unfortunately for us. She could have been the queen of the erotic thrillers.
Her and Shannon Worry teaming up and having a marshmallow boobathon.
Oh, God. Okay, I gotta stop. Okay, we also had Molly, who was the good girl, played by Renee Estevez.
Yes,
who
another was, Estevez acting in movies.
Yep, Charlie and Emilio's sister.
And Joe Estevez is her uncle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she was also an Intruder, if you're a fan of
which I definitely am a fan of Intruder.
Yeah. There was also a character named TC that I really liked. He was this, like, he had a mullet. He reminded me of, like, Randy West or something. But yeah, he hasn't really been in a lot that I really noted.
TC was the guy who was, like, trying to, like, be nice to Molly and, like, didn't she have a crush on him or something?
I don't think she had, no, because she liked that other kind of studly guy.
There was a lot of guys in this with, like, their tight tops again, like the first movie.
Yeah, it didn't quite stand out as much as the first
movie. Well, no, that's kind of hard to when they're all in crop tops with short shorts in the first movie.
Or when they're just not wearing tops in this one at all.
That's true.
You know, I thought there was some neat things about this. I mean, all the characters were named after 80s actors, which I thought was kind of cool.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
So you had, like, Ali Sheedy, Molly Ringwald. TC was supposed to be Tom Cruise.
Oh, okay. Yep.
So every character in this was named after, like, some actor from the era. One of the lead roles is played by Pamela Springsteen, which is Bruce Springsteen's sister.
I actually thought she was really good in this.
I thought she was okay, but I think the jokey element of it, we've had this conversation a million times.
Happy Camper song.
Yeah, the Happy Camper song was okay.
Remember the drunken variation of the Happy Camper song? I'm a happy camper. I love to drink and fuck. And if you pay me money on my titties, you can suck. Don't you remember that?
By the Shit
Sisters. The Shit Sisters?
Yeah. Yeah, they didn't have enough screen time, I thought. They were like these stoner chicks. I thought,
wasted! Yeah. They see that all through the
movie. I kind of liked them. They didn't last very long, though.
No.
There were some interesting deaths.
There was a lot of deaths in this movie because they had that quota.
Yeah, there were some good deaths. I did enjoy some of the deaths. I liked the the fact that there was, yeah, like I said, there was some real good 80s memorabilia on display, like the LP. I also, there was also a Poison Look What the Cat Dragged In album somewhere. And
hey, they were on Enigma.
Yeah.
That album was on Enigma.
Really? Yeah. I didn't know that. Yeah. And there were, you know, there were references to Freddy and Leatherface and Jason. So, you know, it was very kind of winky, winky movie.
I think that might be why I like it more than the first one.
Yeah.
Because I also did see the second one, like, when I was more in that age where I was, like, early teens when I was really getting into slasher movies.
Yeah.
And I had only seen the first one fleetingly, and I didn't like it.
Mm.
So that might be why I still like two better than one.
Right. Yeah, and I've heard mixed between two but and I three do, as well, right?
I don't like three.
Yeah.
I mean, I've revisited this whole series in the last, like, 3 years or something like that, and I don't like three anymore, and I used to like three.
Yeah.
So it's weird. I still like two better than one, but I just... We'll see. You're probably going to have three for next time.
Yeah, so far, I mean, I can't... I definitely would revisit one. I don't know if I'd... I don't know how often I'd go back to this
one. Now, did you watch the Blu-ray of two?
Yes.
So it's the uncut version, then?
I guess so, yeah.
Okay. Because there was an R-rated version that cuts out quite a bit.
Oh, well. Based on the nudity, this was not cut.
Don't have AIDS, do you?
What's that? Yeah. Yeah, so it's pretty enjoyable. I actually ordered Return to Sleepaway Camp as well.
Oh God, dude, you're gonna regret that.
I haven't completed it. So I had to. I needed to know. So I'll be doing that one pretty soon.
So this is your new series, is what you're telling me.
Well, I'm halfway done.
All right,
it's a quickie.
That's true.
All right, moving on.
You're halfway done, and I just started a series, and it's going to be a long fucking road out of hell, dude.
Man, that sounds awful.
It's going to be a long road out of hell. Might as well reveal what it is.
Yeah,
I watched 1984's Children of the Corn.
Oh, did you actually start watching this series? Oh, dude.
Yeah, dude.
Oh, so we have to listen to you talk about the shitty Children of the Corn
sequels? Yeah, but judging on the series, it'll probably be fast. I'll just be like, it's same plot as last movie, moving on. It's shit. Hey, John Franklin's back in part six.
And you bought every one of them?
Well, see, I bought the first...
Like, why?
I bought the first one. Okay, here's my logic.
There is no logic.
It's a little bit logic. So the first movie was put out on Blu-ray by Anchor Bay in like 2009 or 10.
Yeah.
And it was the 25th anniversary edition. So yeah, 2009. It went out of print really fast. But it was the only one that had special features on it.
Right.
So I recently bought a copy off of somebody of that one. And I was like, you know, they've released all the sequels 2 through 7 in one set, and it's like $10. So I'm like, I'm a movie person, and I buy way too many fucking movies. Why don't I just throw another $10 on the table and get Children of the Corn 2 through 7?
Yeah, but $10 and 10 hours of your life.
Yeah, well, whatever. And then I was like, you know, while I'm at it, you know, I remember Dimension put out those shitty, like, Children of the Corn Genesis and then that Hellraiser Revelations. So I'm like, I can get a Children of the Corn Genesis brand new for $5. Might as well buy that, too. So the only thing I didn't buy was the 2009 Sci-Fi Channel remake.
Don't.
So.
Don't buy that.
I'm not buying it. I'm just subjecting. Wow. Thanks, Mom.
There is no redeeming quality to that remake.
Nothing.
Nothing. It's fucking terrible.
Okay, well. So I buy these, and now I'm like, you know, I might as well start my long road into hell. So we're talking about Children of the Corn now. Based on a Stephen King story, which I am almost proof positive he ripped off the basic premise from the 1976 Spanish movie Who Can Kill a Child?
Right.
Because it's very similar. The story's pretty basic. It's about a bunch of kids who kill all the adults in the town and worship a god who lives in the cornfield. And Linda Hamilton and Peter Horton are a young couple who are passing through and get caught up in the middle of all this murderous tyke rampaging stuff. Opening scene in this movie is...
Dude, even this one is terrible.
Dude, the opening scene in this movie is great.
Okay, I'll give you that.
Yeah, so I don't know if I should say what it is, but let's just say...
I think it's okay to say what it is.
Okay, so the opening scene in the movie is just... you know, everyone's...
It might get someone to watch it.
Everyone's come out of church on a Sunday. They're all at the diner. A couple of the kids from the town come in, lock the doors of the diner, and proceed to slaughter all the adults in the diner. It's a pretty great scene. You know, there's a guy who gets his hand fed into, like, a meat slicer in it.
Oh,
like,
yeah, yeah.
It's pretty sweet. And then it turns to Malachi and... what's his name? I wrote it down. Malachi and Isaac are the two main guys. So Malachi is played by Courtney Gaines, who's this like really ugly, kind of tall, redheaded, long-haired guy.
Yeah.
He fits the role perfectly. It creeped me out to find out that he was actually charged like a few years back with actually stalking women.
Really?
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah. So I'm like, fuck, how's that? You're getting stalked by fucking Malachi.
Oh,
he's
my God.
Probably like in the bushes with like one of the fucking corn husking tools they use in this movie. Like, it's like fucking creepy.
How many years ago was that?
I think it was like in 2010.
Really? He was in Rob Zombie's Halloween.
Was he?
Yeah, he was like, remember there was like Lou Temple and him and they were like raped that girl in Michael Myers' like cell or whatever?
Huh.
In the uncut version?
Huh.
It's super gross, like, and he's like one of them.
It just adds something to the fact that he's a real life stalker, that he has a rape scene in a Rob Zombie movie.
Yeah,
it's a little bit creepy. John Franklin plays Isaac, and he does return in part 6.
Oh boy.
And he co-wrote part 6, so be looking forward to that one, folks.
God.
It's directed by a guy called Fritz Kirsch, who did one of Josh's favorite 80s gang movies, Tough Turf, which is a great movie. And he also did a movie called Under the Boardwalk in the 80s, which I kind of like. It's kind of like another one of those teen gangs, but it's like surfers versus like the rich kids.
Oh, yeah.
So it's kind of a fun movie. It's got Keith Coogan in it. You know, Keith Coogan.
Who's Keith Coogan?
Nobody knows who he is, but...
Why do you know that?
I don't know, because he's like this... He's kind of this nerdy guy who... He was in like a handful of movies in the 80s, and just his name has always stuck with me. Keith Coogan. So...
Okay.
Trailer Corn's not bad, dude. Like, the original. It isn't that bad. You know, it's got that massacre. It gets super silly in the finale because there's all this religious fervor going on and, like, some really poor visual effects where, like, you know, it's, like, really badly done early pre-CG effects. So it looks like someone basically hooked up their Atari to the screen made it melt people down. So that's kind of bad. But it moves pretty quickly. You know, it's got some creepy stuff in it. Like, it's got a really cool scene where Linda Hamilton's character is in a house with this little girl and her brother who have, like, kind of gone off from the group because they want to play. And Isaac and Malachi is like, you guys can't play. You can't have fun. We've got to worship he who walks behind the rose.
Right.
And they all come to the house. And it's kind of like a home invasion kind of situation. So it's, like, a cool shot of them just standing outside the house just from, like, the waist down with holding their weapons.
It's
a shot that's been used in many movies before, but I thought it was really like, I like shots like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. I just think they're pretty cool and creepy. And that's all I got to say. I just know that, now I got to slug my way through 7 more of these fuckers.
I just, when the first one is as okay as this one, I just can't even imagine.
Yeah, it's like
imagine.
The first one is just okay.
Exactly.
So it's like, it's all down here from downhill from here, baby. Like, seriously. I actually remember the
you're
first...
You're not going to make it, dude.
I probably won't.
No, you won't.
I remember the first 3 being okay, and then after that, it's like a fucking nosedive. Like, because the second one was, like, called Urban Harvest. I remember there was a cool scene in it with this, like, fucking... corn thresher running someone over. I remember that. That's okay. All I remember. Part 3 was like, oh, this Amish kind of corn worshiping kid goes to the city and goes into a city high school and gets picked on and he kills them with the corn he's been growing in an abandoned factory. And that one's directed by Anthony D.R. Hickox.
Okay.
Who did
Waxwork.
Waxwork, yeah. So, I mean, it's got that going for it. And then after that, it's like fucking such... unmemorable, like fucking same plot. So
wow,
you'll be hearing me going, yeah, I watched this movie, you know, Children of Corn 5, Fields of Terror, and
okay, so you're gonna watch part 2 for next time?
I'm gonna try.
Okay.
I'm gonna try. No promises.
Place your bets, people.
Yeah. Will Chris talk about Cholnar Corn 2, The Final Sacrifice, or will he not?
It would be one of those, oh, fuck, I can't do it. That would be me.
Yeah. I'll come in. Oh, when we record next episode, you'd be like, so, did you watch Cholnar Corn 2? I'll be like, dude, 20 minutes. We'll see what happens.
Okay, well, I'm glad you bought all of them. Just please don't buy the remake.
God. I didn't buy the remake, but I've got 1 through 8, so okay. Gird your loins, people.
Isn't 6 like 666?
Yeah, it's Cholnar Corn 666. I think it has a subtitle too. Isaac's Return.
Honestly, this has got to be the one franchise that I just don't understand at all.
I don't get it.
Why,
I don't get
why
it.
There's so many.
I don't know why they even had to make 2.
Yeah,
I don't get that. There's another franchise that most people won't know called Witchcraft.
Oh, well, I know why the Witchcraft.
Well, yeah, tits. I guess it's like 17 of those or something ridiculous.
Yeah, they're up to, yeah, I think 14 or something. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I don't get the Cholnar Corn thing myself, and they're apparently going to be making another one.
Ugh, God.
Yeah, I don't get it.
No.
It's like, it's not even one of Stephen King's stronger stories, no. To be honest. We'll see.
Yeah. All right. Well, there's 10 minutes of your life you won't have back, people.
Hey, it was 92 minutes of my life I won't get back. And I've seen that movie at least 3 times in my life, so that's 4.5 hours.
You know what I will say about it? It is memorable. I do think about that movie when I'm driving through cornfields.
Cholnar Corn's fairly entertaining.
I remember Malachi.
Yeah.
I remember Isaac.
Well, that's the thing. Right? Those two guys are such like creepy fucking freaks. So
yeah,
that's why I think that's why it works better than it should.
Yeah. And had a cool poster.
That's true. It's true.
All right. I'm going to knock off a couple of quickies here.
It just reminds me of that corn song that they did with Ice Cube back in the day. Chew the corn.
I don't remember that.
It's terrible.
Okay, I'm gonna knock through 3 real quick ones here.
All right.
Because I believe they're all Dollarama specials.
Oh no.
But and I normally I don't talk about Dollarama titles, but these ones I thought were worth bringing up. So the first one I watched is called Inhale. This is from 2010. It's directed by an Icelandic director named Balthazar Kormákr, and he's been actually making some more mainstream movies lately. He did that Two Guns movie with Denzel Washington
and Marky Mark.
And is Mark Wahlberg in that?
I think so.
Yeah, I think so too. And he also did that Everest movie based on the John Krakauer story.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Cool. So this one, I just thought it was kind of a cool premise, and I thought it was quite well done. It's starring Dermot Mulroney and Diane Kruger. Diane Kruger, people might recognize her from, like, Inglourious Basterds. And Dermot Mulroney's been in tons of stuff, like Living in Oblivion and Where the Day Takes You, and he's been in all kinds of movies. Anyway, so pretty good cast. We also have Sam Shepard's in this, and Rosanna Arquette's in this, and Vincent Perez, a.k.a. The Bad Crow.
The Bad Crow.
So the premise of this one is Dermot Mulroney and Diane Kruger have a daughter who's very sick with a form of, I think it's a form of cancer, and they're trying to find a cure for her, and they can't find a way to cure her through traditional medicine. So Dermot Mulroney finds out through a few sources that there's a doctor in Mexico that will treat this. So he goes down to Mexico to try and find this doctor and find a way to have an operation be done on his daughter. And it's pretty gritty. I mean, he goes down there by himself, and he's like searching around, like trying to find this doctor, and he's running into all these like thugs, and he, you know, at one point he gets taken into this like weird like nightclub type place, and he gets like tied up, and then he gets like blown by this tranny hooker, and it's just really, yeah, it's just kind of a, and it's really got this kind of gritty feel to it, and he's always getting his ass kicked, and then eventually he befriends this street kid who kind of helps him out. Meanwhile, Diane Kruger's at home back in the States, and the daughter's getting sicker and sicker, so it's kind of a race against time to save the life of the daughter. And yeah, I thought it was quite a cool little movie. So definitely worth picking up if you see it popping around at Dollarama, if you like gritty little movies that were based in a foreign country and that sort of fish out of water type type thing. And it's definitely not a predictable, like it's definitely got an edge to it.
How old is it?
2010.
Oh, okay.
Next one I watched is called Midnight Movie, which is from 2008, which I know you've seen.
Yeah, I don't mind it.
Directed by Jack Messett. Not really a lot of, the cast is really, I don't really know them from anything. I know the lead girl's played by Rebecca Brandis, but I nothing really of note. And the premise of this is that there's a midnight screening of this movie playing in a movie theater, and the killer, I guess, I don't really under. I think the guy who directed it and starred and wrote the movie is like insane. He's like a murderer.
Yeah, it's like a long lost movie by this guy or something.
So they screen it at this theater, and then as the movie's playing, the killer on the screen is able to like somehow come into the real world. And then when he's stalking someone in the real world, so in the theater, the stalking scene then plays on the screen.
Yeah.
So the people can sort of try and figure out how to get away from the killer by seeing what's going on in the screen. But if they're seeing like their location on the screen, then they know the killer's like coming after them. So it's just kind of a cool, again, like just kind of a cool premise that I thought was pretty well executed. It had some good gore. I thought the film within a film was pretty interesting, and it was in black and white. And yeah, I just thought it was just
his weapon was pretty cool too. It was like this weird kind of corkscrew.
Yeah.
That he used to kill people. It's like a point. It was a point, but it was like corkscrewed around, and he just kind of twisted into people.
It didn't seem very practical.
Not really, but it looked pretty cool.
And it did a lot of damage.
Yeah, it looked pretty cool.
Yeah.
I haven't seen this for a while, but I actually remember that I dig this movie quite a bit.
Yeah, like definitely.
For a low budget kind of what you think is going to be a standard slasher movie, it's got enough ingenuity in it to kind of rise above its budget. And
totally.
I thought the acting was pretty decent considering it's an unknown cast. And
yeah.
I like movies that are kind of set in theaters.
Yeah.
Like horror movies that are set in theaters, like Popcorn or Anguish or, you know, something like that, where it's like kind of...
Demons,
yeah. Where it's kind of like breaking that fourth wall between movies and real life. Because, you know, Demons does that, obviously.
Yeah.
Because they go to like that, you know, the burial site or whatever and...
Yeah, in the movie, and then the same mask in the movie.
And then in Anguish, a lot of that happens too. It's been a while since I've been in Anguish, but a lot of stuff that goes on the screen relates to the people who are watching it, and same thing with Popcorn. I like that concept.
Yeah, me too.
And, you know, I'm glad it hasn't been overused, but I actually think Midnight Movie is actually worth checking out.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, and the director hasn't done anything else. He's more, I think he's a camera operator on a lot of things now on TV, but... Yeah, it's a cool little flick. So again, I'm just bringing these ones up because it's more just like if you see them for like $3, definitely worth.
Yeah, there's two versions of Midnight Movie available though.
Yeah, I did hear that.
There's a theatrical version, which is what you would have watched.
Yeah,
and then there's something called the Killer Cut.
Yeah,
and I'm not sure what the changes are because I haven't watched it. I have it at home, but I haven't watched it.
Yeah, there's a comparison online. It doesn't sound like it really matters that much.
Yeah, it's a fun movie regardless.
Yeah.
You should just, if you see it for cheap, check her out.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
The third one is also a Dollarama special. This one's, now I have a, as people know, I have a kind of thing for Crazy Girl movies.
Well, which I do too.
So yes, you do. So hopefully we're going to do an episode on Crazy Girls one day.
Hopefully. So this I've been slowly getting ready.
I know you're slowly getting ready for a lot of topics.
Yeah, I know.
So this one is
don't friggin' bring up our dirty laundry on air.
This one, Bond. This one is.
Oh, you asshole! I heard that.
This one's called Homecoming.
Oh yeah, I've seen this. And Misha Barton, right?
Misha Barton. Yeah,
I've seen this.
So, you've seen it?
Yeah, like I've seen it.
You've actually seen the movie?
Yeah.
Oh, I liked this one.
I didn't mind it. It was okay.
So this is from 2009, directed by Morgan J. Freeman, not Freckles.
No, American Psycho 2, right?
American Psycho 2, and an interesting movie called Desert Blue.
Well, American Psycho 2 is not interesting. It sucks.
Does it?
Yeah.
Isn't that that
Mila Kunis?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's no good?
It's not good. Mila Kunis and William Shatner. That's all you need to know.
Oh, American Psycho is just one of those movies that shouldn't have a sequel.
No, shouldn't.
So in this one, we got this kind of jock guy who's returning back to his hometown with his girlfriend and to have his high school football jersey retired. And he gets back to the town, and I guess Misha Barton plays his old flame, who hasn't quite let go of his her love for him. So she's kind of thinking that he left and went to school, but she's been kind of waiting for him to come home. I guess he didn't. It sounds like maybe he didn't break up with her properly. Like he just sort of one of those, like he left and came back, but when he left, he didn't really sever the tie. And maybe maybe was leading her on a bit, but I also think she's just crazy.
Well, exactly.
So, he comes back and he goes to this bar that she now owns with his girlfriend. And she comes up to him and thinks that they're still together. But then he's like, look, I'm not with you anymore. I've got this new girl, blah, blah, blah. And she's kind of devastated. One thing leads to another. And for some reason, his new girlfriend doesn't want to stay at the family home with him. So she decides to check into a motel. But the motel is full because there's this homecoming or whatever. So she decides to start walking down this highway at night and try and find a place to stay. As she's walking down the highway, Misha Barton's driving home from work and runs her down and then takes her into the house and then ties her to the bed and cares for her misery style.
Yep.
Because apparently, I guess her mother died in the house, so she still has all the medicine. So yeah, it turns into this kind of like misery-like story where Misha Barton's holding this woman captive. And I don't really understand why, like, there's no real upside to holding this woman captive. Like, I don't get why she just doesn't kill her and it's done. But no, instead she holds her captive and, you know, kind of leaves it so, she, you know, this woman can kind of get around a little bit. So the woman, of course, when Misha's out, you know, explores the house. It goes into her room and finds out it's like this freaky shrine to the boyfriend with like pictures everywhere. And it's really kind of creepy. And, you know, there's another scene where she like sneaks into the bathroom and finds like under the toilet, like all the like plans of how like Misha Barton like murdered her own mother and stuff. So it's just kind of stupid that way, because I'm just like, why would she just not kill this girl and go get the guy back, right? Like, there's no real reason to keep this girl alive. But I guess if she didn't do it, it wouldn't be a movie. But there's like, you know, a scene kind of like the hobbling scene in Misery, and not quite to that extent, but there's, yeah, anyway, but it was really entertaining. Like, I just couldn't stop watching it. I thought Misha was great. Like, I thought she was a little unhinged, and I think she might be a little unhinged in real life.
I think so.
I don't know if that's true or not. I know she's definitely had a few problems. This also starred Michael Landis, who was in Final Destination 2. It also has Jessica Stroop. She plays the new girlfriend, and she's going to be one of the leads in Iron Fist, the new Marvel series that's coming out. And she was also in the Prom Night remake, and she's been on The Following as well, that TV series. I really kind of liked this movie. You know, and it's just one of these ones that's just got like some really, really odd scenes. Like, you know, Misha, there's one part where she like murder someone like pretty gross, like brutally, and then burns the body, and then the next scene she's like pulls out this big like thing of ham out of the fridge and sits down and makes this like ham sandwich, and it's like this 5-minute scene of her eating this ham sandwich. Doesn't make any sense, but I really liked all the characters, and I love movies like this, so definitely worth a pickup if you're into the crazy girl genre.
I was actually looking, and I've reviewed this on site.
Have you?
Yeah.
What did you give it?
2.5 out of 4.
See?
I was looking at my notes because I was like, it's been a while since I saw it. I said that it's a movie that a horror movie fan wouldn't be caught dead watching because it appeals kind of to an MTV crowd, but there's something about it that it's watchable and competently made.
It is?
So you're just like, you know, it's all right.
I don't know. I have no shame with the crazy girl subgenre.
I have one at home that I picked up that I'm looking forward to that I might actually have to watch now, called Scorned from 2000 and...
Shannon Tweed.
No, not that one.
Oh.
This one stars from 2010, and it stars Annalyn McCord.
Okay.
From Excision.
Yeah, Excision.
And Billy Zane.
Oh.
Yeah.
Nice.
So I might have to check it out now. Maybe I'll get no crazy girl mood.
I think I've pretty much decided that it's impossible to make a shitty movie in this genre, at least in through my
crazy
eyes.
Girl movies?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think I've seen a bad one.
I have.
What?
Obsessed.
I loved Obsessed.
Oh, you're wrong.
No, I'm not. No, I'm not. Just because it's Beyonce doesn't mean she can't be nuts. And she was. All right. Anyway, so there's three. If you see them at your local cheap thrift store, then go for it.
Okay. Next movie I watched was just because I found the DVD for cheap, and I wanted to watch it before I gave it to Josh so he could try and get his collection complete of these. I watched How to Make a Monster.
Yes.
It's a 2001 movie. It was part of this very short-lived line of films made for cable. So they aired on, like, I think they aired on, like, HBO and Showtime.
Yeah.
And it was called Creature Features. It was produced by effects master Stan Winston.
Yeah.
And the whole and it was also produced by Samuel Zarkoff's son. And the concept behind this was it was very loose remakes of old American international pictures, 50s monster movies.
Yeah.
So there was, you know, The Earth versus the Spider, She Creature, Teenage Caveman.
The Day the World Ended.
The Day the World Ended and How to Make a Monster. Yeah. There was only 5 movies in this series.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. So How to Make a Monster is basically, it's a remake of the 1958 movie. Only thing it does is take the title, pretty much.
Oh, okay.
So when I was looking into How to Make a Monster, I was reading about the original, and it actually sounds like a really good movie, and yeah. I've never seen it. It's like the basis of the original is that it's about a special effects artist who works for American International Pictures.
Yeah.
Who all of his credit is not given to him by the producers in the studio. So he uses his monster makeup to get revenge on the studio. So I was like, this sounds awesome.
Right.
So I'm going to have to track it down.
Yeah.
Basis of this movie is a video game company is making a horror game called Evolution.
Nice.
And it sucks. Like right. Like it opens with them having a game test with a bunch of kids, and the kids just laugh at the game and say it's not scary and that the main monsters look stupid and everything. So they call in these rogue programmers. So they call in like these three programmers who are all like distinct, like cliches, I guess. You know, there's like the nerdy guy called Bug who like is into like coding sound and like has no success with women. You know, you've got the strong, smart African-American guy, Solomon, who, like, is good with, like, the AI chip. And then you've got the crazy, like, the crazy big freaking weapons-hungry dude. I can't remember his name in the movie, but Hardcore is his nickname in the movie. He's played by Tyler Mane.
Okay.
Who played Michael Myers in Rob Zombie's versions of Halloween. And also played Sabretooth in the X-Men movie.
Yeah.
So they come in, they're hooked up with Steven Weber, playing like the guy who's the project head who has to make sure they get this game done in a month.
Is Steven Weber on Wings? Is that guy?
Yeah, I think so. And okay. He was also in the Shining TV movie from 2004 or 2007 or whatever it was. Yeah. So he's there to make sure they don't kill each other. Clea DuVall is on hand as like the intern who also wants to be a programmer of her own, but you know, she's just fetching them food and coffee and everything and make sure no one fights. And yeah, they've got a month to finish this game. The company has offered a $1 million bonus for whoever's feature gets most prominently used in the game, which causes them all to bicker and fight with each other. And that kind of stuff is really fun. Like the three programmer guys are just like at each other and like pulling pranks on each other to like kind of sabotage each other. And I found that stuff to be really fun.
Yeah.
But of course, this being a sci-fi horror movie, lightning strikes the building.
Of course.
Gets into the mainframe of the computer. Brings the creature from the video game.
The mainframe. I haven't heard that in a long time. Oh,
mainframe. I listened to How Did This Get Made, where they're talking about the Lawnmower Man.
Yeah.
And they mentioned mainframe. So, yeah. So, lightning strikes it. brings the monster out of the video game into real life with them trapped in there, and it proceeds to, you know, take over and kill them and everything because they've made this like kind of motion capture suit, which the monster takes control of and kind of uses to its advantage. Speaking of this motion capture suit, Josh,
I'm kind of feeling like I know why you gave this to me now.
Here's something you'll enjoy, and this will make you watch it instantly. There is a scene in this movie where they call in Julie Strain.
Okay, done.
Where she is brought in and she's playing herself. They bring her in so they can motion capture her with this suit. Their whole thing is they need to get her naked.
Yeah.
Because they're like, oh, you know, the suit doesn't work unless you have no clothes on. So she's like, my agent told me there'd be no nudity. So she's like making fun of the fact that every movie she's done, she's been nude in, right? So there's a scene in this movie, Josh, where she's wearing the suit with nothing else, swinging a sword around while they motion capture.
But she's wearing the suit.
No, but everything's showing, dude.
Oh, okay.
Like, it's just straps basically down the sides of her. What you're there for are on prominent display.
Okay.
So she's like kind of swinging the sword around, like kind of like so they can motion capture it while the guys keep making quips at her about being naked and are drooling about her being naked.
Nice.
It's great. It's sold. Great. It's great because Julie Strain makes fun of herself.
Yeah.
And I like that because, you know, she's known for just, you know, being in these really bad movies and being naked.
Yeah.
So it's nice to see that she has a sense of humor about that.
Yes.
So from here, the movie just becomes kind of like a slasher movie.
Yeah.
Trapped in a building. And I found it a little bit dull, admittedly. Some of the special effects were kind of cool because there's, you know, some body modification stuff that goes on a little bit. I was enjoying some of the interplay between the characters because this is written and directed by a guy called George Huang.
Okay.
He made a movie in 1994 called Swimming with Sharks.
Oh, it's a great
starring
movie.
Kevin Spacey and Frank Whaley, which I think is like one of my favorite black comedies of the 90s. So I found that his knack for dialogue in that movie carried over a little bit to this movie, but I found him to be a very odd choice to helm a horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't really done much since Swimming with Sharks, and I just found it a weird choice because he made this really dark comedy about the workplace and having an asshole boss. And I just didn't get why he would be hired for this.
Yeah.
And you can tell he doesn't really handle the horror stuff that great.
Right. Yeah.
And you can tell that these movies were super low budget. You can just tell. It just looks it because it's set in like basically three rooms.
Yeah.
So, I mean, don't get me wrong. It's not terrible.
Yeah.
It's just a movie that's like kind of, unless you're into that whole, I want to see these creature feature movies. I think the concept that they came up with for these creature feature movies was really fun and could have really been something if it went more than five movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate that, but this is probably on the lower scale of these five movies. Like,
okay.
She Creature's definitely better. Earth versus the Spider is better. Yeah. And I haven't seen the other two.
Yeah.
So it's pretty, it has good parts to it, but it's pretty overall, generally, unless you're wanting to complete this series, pretty skippable.
Yeah, I think this one and the World Ended, or I'm not that interested in them. I mean, it's definitely the other three that I'm, but I did want to complete the series, so thank you.
Julie Strain, Josh.
I didn't know Julie Strain was in it, so
Yeah.
All right, well, next one I'm going to bring up is one I've been yapping about forever.
Oh, geez.
And finally, I got to see it. I, the Jury.
Oh, yeah.
So we've been talking about this one for a while, and then Kino actually put it out.
Because we have that gift.
Which I can't believe. So I was so happy to be throwing this on, and I got to say, man, like, this is a remake of a movie from the 50s, and it's based on the character of Mike Hammer from Mickey Spillane. I think this is quite a bit different from the book. This is like an 80s pulp movie, and like it's Armand Asante's playing Mike Hammer, which is kind of an odd choice, but like the movie opens up.
Wasn't there other movies based on Mike Hammer where it was Stacy Keach?
There was a TV series.
Yeah. Okay.
With Tanya Roberts played Velda.
Yeah, so Armin DeSante is a little bit of a weird choice.
Yeah. But the movie opens up with, you know, he gets this call that he's supposed to, he's got this guy in his office and the guy's hiring him to, like, watch his wife because he thinks that his wife's cheating on him. And then the next scene is Mike Hammer in bed with the guy's wife. So it's just sort of setting up what kind of character this is.
Ladies,
then it cuts
man.
To this, like, awesome opening sequence of opening credit sequence where it's like, you know, shots of Asante just with a gun and he'll, like, turn and, like, point his gun and then it'll, like, cut to the next credit. And it's got this real funky, like, opening music. So you really get into this movie really fast. This is like the 80s action movie that because I watched this a lot when I was young, and watching it now, I'm just like, Jesus Christ, I can't believe my parents let me watch this.
Well, I let you watch Raw Force, at least part of it.
Yeah, this is up there with Raw Force, but I mean, it's just kind of, this is what I think of when I think of like an awesome 80s action movie, because it's got everything. It's gory, it's got crazy funky music, it's got nudity, it's got like cool characters, it's got gunfights, it got car chases. It's awesome. I loved every minute of this, and I am so thankful for Kino for putting this out. Now, I don't think everyone's gonna agree with this. I mean, this is certainly not a great movie. This is not Chinatown, you know. This is like an 80s B movie, but it is a lot of fun. Some of the other things about it, I mean, we have all kinds of, the whole premise of the movie is that Mike Hammer's friend, gets killed, and his friend, of course, only has one leg, which is also kind of a weird thing that happens, and he gets like murdered by this woman, and so Hammer starts tracking down what's going on, and it leads him to this like sex clinic that's run by Barbara Carrera, and it's a place where couples can go to improve their sex life by fucking other people. So we've got Barbara Carrera as this quote unquote sex therapist, and Mike Hammer like is tracking her down, and like just she's like, sort of like the femme fatale. He gets to the sex clinic and there's like all these girls everywhere, and he goes into this one room and he's like surrounded by women. It's kind of like one of those images I think of when I think of this movie. Two of the women are played by Lee and Lynette Harris, aka the twins from Sorceress, the Jack Hill movie. And they're just these real kind of slutty twins. We cut to an orgy scene. The orgy scene has like a whole bunch of real porn stars in it, like Samantha Fox, Bobby Astor, Candida Royale, Marlene Willoughby. So you've got all these like real porn stars in this orgy scene. This was written by Larry Cohen, who was also the original director, but he got fired after the first week. And then they brought on Richard T. Heffron. We've got a crazy kind of like hitman type guy that's also like involved in the whole plot, and he's played by Judson Spence, and he was this like blonde guy from the VTV series that I totally remembered, and like whenever I see this guy on screen, he's super menacing to me. And he likes to dress women up in a red wig before he slaughters them. This has like the end sequence takes place at this like big like rich person's house, like almost like a compound, but there's all these like booby traps everywhere that like are trying to get Mike Hammer. Like there's like, you know, those things like in First Blood where like a, you know, a piece of wood will come swinging out that has like spikes on it and shit like that. This is, yeah, it's super fun. Laureen Landon plays Velda. You know, B-movie fans will know her from Yellow Hair and the Fortress of Gold and Hundra and, of course, All the Marbles.
Yep.
Yeah, so just a great, fun, violent, crazy 80s action movie that I'd highly recommend picking up if you're a fan of B-movies. So this is out by Kino. Thank you.
But, I'm a fan of Larry Cohen.
Yeah, this is everything I thought it would be, and it was so cool to see it in widescreen and cleaned up, because all I know is a shitty VHS version of this. I've never seen it like this, and yeah, it was a blast. So really wish they had made more with Asante, because I thought he was perfectly cast, despite the fact that I didn't think that when I first, you know, I don't think of him when I think of Mike Hammer, but yeah, it was great. But Mike Hammer or Mickey Spillane traditionalists will probably, this will probably drive them crazy. But
I always just thought of like Stacy Keach, like I said.
Yeah, I think you would love this movie. Being a fan of 80s action movies, this is like,
oh yeah, I'm a fan of 80s.
This is like everything. Like it's like all those like Schwarzenegger and Stallone. It's like all of them, but like sleazy. So yeah, it's
great. Man, maybe I should have bought this Blu-ray.
You should buy it. I really think you'll love it.
All right.
Well, I'd almost be willing to watch it again tonight if you wanted to after.
Well, it's Kino, so Kino does a good job. So let's talk. I've got two left. What do you got left?
I have two left, one of which
is we're both talking about. Okay. So let's talk about my last one, then we'll talk about your last one, then we'll talk about the one we watched together.
Okay.
So my last one is the worst one I'm going to talk about. So
it's worse than Children of the Corn?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
So I find Adam Green to be kind of an interesting character in the horror world, okay? So he made the Hatchet movies.
Yes.
He made Frozen, which you really liked.
Yeah.
He made the show Holliston, which, you know, I kind of watched the first season and was kind of indifferent about it. I didn't think it was anything I wanted to pursue. But he also has a podcast with other genre director, Joe Lynch, called, what's it called again? Shit. I can't remember
what it's called. The Movie Crypt.
The Movie Crypt. Yeah. And that's actually a really good podcast. It's really worth listening to.
Yeah, it really is.
It's got a lot of insight in it, and they have a lot of cool guests on there. And so, you know, there's things I like about them. I haven't seen the Hatchet movies. I haven't seen Frozen, admittedly. I watched this movie. This is my first time watching a movie he directed. It's a movie called Digging Up the Marrow.
Yeah.
It's a movie I was interested to see just because of its premise. So the premise of the movie is this. Before I start, I would just like to say this movie is the pure definition of a vanity project. The reason I say that is because Adam Green plays the main character in this movie as himself.
Right.
He wrote, he directed it, obviously. It's a faux documentary where he gets a letter from a man who says, I know where there's an entranceway to an underground society of deformed creatures.
Okay.
So this guy is played by Ray Wise. Okay. Who most people know from numerous things.
Twin Peaks.
Yeah, Twin Peaks amongst others. Yeah. And so Adam Green's just kind of like, you know, I'm going to take him up on this. I'm going to go and see what he's talking about, because this guy's always talking about something called the Marrow. That's where they live. So the whole movie is basically him going and interviewing this character played by Ray Wise about, you know, what's down there, what monsters are there, so on and so forth, while cutting back to him basically sitting at his desk at his Arioscope studio saying how awesome he is and how his movies are great and his fans love him and all this kind of shit. And I'm like, I have a very low tolerance for that because it felt very egotistical to me.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. And I mean, I know you, I'm just like, I didn't think that that would be something he would do.
No.
He seems so kind of down to earth and like, you know, chilled out with everybody. But in this movie, I just got the feeling that it's like, you know, he was just like kind of saying, you know, I'm great. Look at me.
Wow.
I'm patting myself on the back here, you know?
Yeah.
And I didn't really like that part of the movie. Also, when it comes to the script, I felt like saying to the screen many times, hey, Adam, I've seen Nightbreed before. Many times.
Oh, okay.
This is basically Nightbreed, dude.
Yeah.
You're talking about a secret society of monsters who live underground. This is Nightbreed.
Wow.
If okay. I want to watch that story, I will watch Nightbreed.
Right.
Also, kind of like another one, I found it weird that they cast Ray Wise as the main guy in this, because everybody knows who he is.
Right, right.
So okay, if you're trying to purport your movie as being a real movie, don't have a fucking name actor in it who everybody will recognize.
Yeah.
Go the route of casting unknown people.
Yeah.
You know, I found that really an odd choice.
Yeah.
I was just like, why are you casting a real actor in this? You want people to believe this is a true documentary.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be doing that.
Right.
So I found that was a weird choice. And also, much like another found footage, supposedly real movie that we've talked about in the past, Willow Creek.
Right.
By Bobcat Goldthwait. This movie goes nowhere for the first hour.
Yeah.
Like nowhere. It's just basically interview scenes, Adam saying how great he is, sitting in the woods looking for something, thinking they see something and not really seeing something. And then in the last 20 minutes, shit happens.
Okay.
So it's much like Willow Creek in that sense, but I enjoyed Willow Creek a bit more than this.
Ah, too bad.
It's like I said, I just found it to be very vanity, egotistical for some reason. It rubbed me the wrong way.
Yeah.
Because from the impressions I've gotten from him from, you know, just being on, you know, just his public image, like from the podcast, from all that kind of stuff, I wouldn't have expected that kind of thing from him, right?
Well, they do talk about themselves a lot on that podcast. Like, I could see...
I mean, you talk about... Everyone talks about themselves in the sense of, like, what's going on in their lives.
Yeah, but I've listened a few times where they're promoting their own shit for, like, 20 minutes before they even get into anything.
Yeah, so...
So I can kind of see that, but at the same time, I'm kind of like, well, fuck, it's your podcast. You can do whatever the hell you want.
Well, true.
Kind of how I feel about ours, right?
Right. But I felt like this movie took too long to get where it was going.
Yeah.
It had some... That casting decision was poor. And the premise had been done before by Clive Barker.
Yeah.
26 years prior.
Yeah. No, that's too bad.
It was a disappointment.
Yeah.
For my first experience with one of his movies, it was a disappointment. I'm still going to watch the Hatchet movies, and I'm definitely going to watch Frozen.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just one of those things where you never want to go into a movie thinking you're going to be disappointed. And then when they are disappointing... It kind of is a spirit breaker. Like, after I watched this movie, I was kind of bummed out for a little bit because I wanted it to be so much more than it was.
Yeah. I mean, it's not one that's... I don't know why, but I just haven't really been running out to watch this. And I've also found it's quite difficult to find up here in Canada.
Yeah, I rented it for like a dollar on VOD.
Yeah, and I've tried VOD. Like, I can't find it on any of my normal VOD routes, so...
Yeah, I watched it on PlayStation Network.
So. Right, yeah.
But yeah, I can't recommend it.
Yeah, it's too bad.
I mean, I'm still going to check out his other stuff, but it just rubbed me the wrong way.
Yeah. So. Huh. Too bad.
Yeah, it is too bad. It's a bummer.
Yeah.
Aw.
It's okay.
Children of Corn's better.
No.
No.
All right, I'm gonna do my last one here. So I'm gonna do my usual, my now usual.
Should I cue it up?
Yeah.
Josh's VHS Adventure.
That's right. So I'm actually enjoying this quite a bit. So this is number four into the entry of VHS land.
Four or three?
It's four.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we had Stigma.
Yeah.
And then we had Framed.
Yeah.
And then we had Beyond Atlantis.
Oh, okay.
And now Soul Patrol.
Soul Patrol. Oh, this sounds promising.
Yeah, okay.
Well, title-wise.
So this is a 1976 movie.
Preach it, brother. Let's hear more.
Directed by Christopher Rowley, who no one will know who that is, although he has done some other stuff, a.k.a. Black Trash.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know there was such thing as a South African blaxploitation movie until I watched Soul Patrol.
South African, really?
So this is a South African movie. Certainly not marketed as such on the VHS box. This looks like a typical American blaxploitation movie, but no, it's South African. And this is about a guy named Chaka, and he's a reporter. Okay, so let me set it up. The movie opens up with this. This guy trying to get this black guy trying to get this boxer to throw a fight or something, and then the guy goes down to the parking garage with his girlfriend, the guy that's trying to get the other guy to throw a fight, and then he's murdered by, he gets into his car, and then this big pickup truck just starts ramming the shit out of the car that they're in, and then kills him. And then a few scenes later we have a pimp getting killed. So we're seeing that these like criminals are being murdered. So this guy named Chaka, played by Ken Gampu, and this guy was in American Ninja 4 and King Solomon's Mine. So he's been in some movies, but he's a South African actor. He's playing this reporter who's investigating what's going on with these murders. and he teams up with a cop played by Nigel Davenport, and who you'll know from the Island of Dr. Moreau from the 1970s. He was in Nighthawks, and he was in Phase 4. So they team up together, and what happens is that it's revealed to Chaka that there's this this group in town that's trying to, like, clean up the streets. So they're, like, killing the... They're basically vigilantes. So Chaka's kind of investigating this group, and he's working with the cop, and they're kind of working together so Chaka can get a good story and the cop can bust these guys. One thing leads to another, and we eventually... I don't know if, I guess it doesn't really matter if I spoil this too much, because probably no one's going to ever watch it. But, you know, the group isn't exactly what it's cracked up to be. Their reasoning for killing the criminals is not necessarily just to try and improve society. There's ulterior motives at play. You know, I mean, when I looked at the cover for this movie, I mean, it has four black guys, like, kind of holding weapons, like, kind of walking towards the camera. So I was like, oh, shit, this is like a black gang movie. No, this is not a black gang movie.
Well, look at that title, Soul Patrol.
I know, like, I was really expecting a lot more. But when I started to figure out what was going on, I was actually kind of impressed that this was this weird South African import. And I actually kind of dug it. It had a really cool hitman, a white guy hitman, played by Burma Stagg. And he's like this guy, and he's got this like cool white suit and a big fucking beard and shades and a hat. And he's like one of those, he's like a real cool hitman guy that like walks around just like, you know, with no feeling, just like blowing everyone away. And he's got some really cool scenes. It's got a pretty decent car chase. It's got a good scene with an assassin and Davenport where they're like chasing each other through like the like kind of jungle area, and they end up at this like house where they're like, you know, like trying to like get at each other, but there's like this like little kid like playing tea with her dolls in the middle of the yard, and like they're trying not to hurt the kid and stuff. There's a really cool scene at an airport where there's like a big gunfight. So it's got all these like kind of cool little set pieces. It's also got some really, you know, stupid dialogue. Like one of the lines I wrote down was, "Look at that moon, so much like a woman waiting to be filled."
What?
Lines like that. Yeah, so just a really kind of curiosity. So I was actually kind of, I was disappointed as it started, but then as the movie went on, I actually kind of ended up digging it. As I looked into it, it actually turns out that this has actually, again, been put out on DVD by Synapse, of all people, under the title Death of a Snowman. So yeah, an interesting one. I'm really kind of thankful for my VHS collection right now, because I would never have seen this movie had I not picked it up back in Jumbo Video all those years ago.
Man, I gotta tell you, I would be disappointed too with a title like Soul Patrol. I would, like, when you said Soul Patrol, right away I was like, oh shit, this is one of those movies where a bunch of brothers go into the jungles to save some POWs.
No.
I'm like, this is awesome.
No, this is more like it had a few action scenes, but this is definitely more like a drama.
Okay.
Like more like a crime drama. But it was kind of worth it. I mean, I'm actually thinking maybe I'll check out that Synapse DVD now. So, you know, because I could barely fucking see anything. I'll tell you, it was a terrible print that I had. And but yeah, it was definitely an interesting thing. And it was just for that one character, this one played by Burma Stagg, and he's the writer as well. So he obviously wrote this part for himself because it was pretty badass. But even just for that guy, it was kind of worth it. He's not on the VHS cover, but he's prominently on the DVD cover. So, Okay. Yeah. So that's Soul Patrol for y'all.
So that's the Josh's VHS Adventure.
That's right.
All right, let's talk about the last movie.
Okay. So I introduced Pris to a movie from the 80s that I really dug, and I tried to convince him to buy it, but he would not listen to me.
But then after we watched it, I said, fuck, I should have bought that.
As usual. But
hey, I told you were right this time.
Oh, remember? Yeah, I'm right again, by the way. We did a big Arrow order from Arrow Video in the UK, and so the one I picked here is called The Last American Virgin.
Yeah.
It's kind of a lesser-known 80s sex comedy.
I've always known about it, but it's just one of those ones that I always just, for some reason, kept passing over.
Yeah.
I can't explain why. It's just like, because I used to be a fiend for these movies, you know. I even watched Rosebud Beach Hotel and
I know, stuff it's like that. Crazy and, that you've never seen this movie.
And I just missed this one, and when Josh ordered it, I was like, okay. When we were doing the order, I was like, should I order it? I don't know. Maybe I'll just let Josh order it, and then we'll see. And then after I watched it, I was like, I regret that.
Yeah.
I should have ordered that.
Yeah.
So hopefully Arrow, if you're listening, another sale, please.
So this is directed by Israeli director Boaz Davidson.
Yep.
And this is a remake of his own film called Lemon something. Lemon Popsicle.
From 1978.
Yeah. So that movie was set in the 50s, I believe.
Yeah, it was set in the 50s, and then it was also shot in Israel. I'm not sure if it was in English. I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it was in English. It spawned like 9 sequels, though.
But Canon Films brought him over to America to remake it.
Yeah.
But the thing was, it had to be set in the 80s.
Yeah.
And you can tell that this decade's shift occurred quite a bit, because the movie's pretty scattershot plot wise.
Well, a little bit. I mean,
it is just a little bit. It's kind of all over the place.
The first hour is pretty much three guys trying to get laid.
Yeah.
And one guy lusting after one particular girl.
Yeah.
Like, he's obviously kind of in love with this one girl, but it's really,
but it doesn't stop him from trying to like bed down with like the Mexican lady who keeps ordering pizza and has sex with all him and his two friends, pretty much.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't like her that much that he won't turn that down.
Well, mind you, I might have. Yeah, I don't. I think I would have turned that down, actually, but
you should see the incredulous look I'm giving him right now.
If you had to go second. Okay, let's not even. Sorry.
He would have been third, wouldn't he?
I would not want to be anything other than first.
Anyway.
So it's got a lot of that stuff going on. You know, I mean, but even in this first bit, I mean, I found one of these scenes in here really quite fucked up. And there was a scene where they hire a hooker, and she's clearly not into it. And it's kind of in this like gross basement, and
yeah, it looks like it's almost in like a warehouse.
Yeah. It's really kind of a dirty scene. Like, you're just like, fuck this. That's, it's not funny. I wasn't laughing.
No. She's kind of like, come on, get over here.
Yeah.
Pull down your pants. Come on, take your pecker out. Let's get this over with.
Yeah. Like, yeah, it was just kind of a gross scene. And so it did have a different tone than a lot of these. But it still had, like, you know, Lawrence Monison plays Gary, who's the main character. You might recognize him as the stoner from Friday the 13th,
Ted.
Part 4. Yeah.
Where's the fucking corkscrew, Ted?
Yeah.
Don't you remember when we were watching this? I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Isn't that guy from fucking Friday the 13th?
Yeah.
This was his first movie.
Yeah, it was. And he hasn't really done a lot, but It also has the token fat guy from every 80s movie sort of had a chubby dude, played by Joe Rabeau. He hasn't done a lot. He played a character named David. He was in Hot Chili. That's really this other.
Oh, yeah. I've always wanted to see that. That's another canon sex comedy with Bronson Pinchot.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Okay. And then the third of the group is this is kind of like the good looking stud one, named Rick, played by Steve Anton. And did you get the trivia on this guy? So this guy, he's been in some movies. You know, he was in Don Coscarelli's Survival Quest. He also played one of the rapists in The Accused, and he was in Penitentiary 3. But the strangest thing about this dude, so this guy was a really pretty good-looking guy and really charismatic and stuff, and all the girls loved him in this movie.
Did he have a sex change?
No, he directed Burlesque.
What?
that movie.
Like the Cher movie?
Yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah. Like, I couldn't believe it. And apparently he's got this big, he's
into musicals?
He's into music. He's gay. He's openly gay, as is Lawrence Monison. Yeah, got into musicals and he directed that Cher movie.
Wow.
I know. Totally bizarre. And like, you know, you watch this movie, you would never in a million years have thought this guy would go on to direct Burlesque.
No.
So yeah, I thought that was quite funny. The girl in this is played by Diane Franklin. Yep. She's kind of the object of Gary's affection. Diane Franklin.
Yeah, Better Off Dead, 1985 with John Cusack.
Yeah.
She was like the French foreign exchange student. I love her in that movie.
Yeah, Chris really liked this girl.
And she was also in Amityville 2, The Possession.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Bill and Ted's. Yeah. And
Terrorvision. I always just thought she was just like a super cute girl who like kind of seemed to be having fun every time she was on screen.
Yeah.
Because in Terrorvision, she played like the daughter, but she was like that punk rock kind of daughter.
Yeah.
So she was always like, she had like the colored, multicolored hair, and she like was always like chewing gum and like, you know, oh God, mom, kind of that. Yeah. So
yeah,
I really liked her in the 80s. I thought she was cute, and I liked her in every movie. Like Better Off Dead's like one of my favorite 80s movies. So.
Yeah. Yeah, and I can definitely see why Gary in this movie had such a crush on her. I mean, she's pretty good looking and super nice and stuff. So, but you know, this movie takes some really interesting turns,
I'll say
it's definitely not a typical movie of this ilk. I really don't want to spoil this one because you know, if you don't really I just really recommend this one quite a bit. It's different and
I've seen a lot of these kind of movies, and to tell you that I've never seen anything like the last third of this movie for this subgenre of movies, and that's all I'm gonna say.
Yeah,
like I cannot. Like you watch this movie and then come back to us, and you'll be like, dudes, you guys. Wow.
Yeah. So try not to, like, if you're at all interested in this.
Yeah, don't look at shit online.
It's a really well done movie. I thought the acting was all really good. I thought the writing was really, I really liked the storyline, and I really liked the direction it took. And I think people will really dig it if you're into 80s teenage movies, right?
Well, it's like I said, I felt it was a little scattershot because it was an Israeli movie being remade.
Right.
For American audiences and being set like 3 decades after the original movie. So I found that added kind of a scattershot quality to the movie because I also felt like they were trying to capture what was going on because Porky's was just the year before and, you know, they were trying to capture some of that lightning in the bottle. So they like kind of had those scenes in there that like, you know, the scene with the pizza delivery and stuff like that. But then at the same time, they had those kind of like these dead serious moments in the movie where you're just kind of like, we're so different from that kind of movie that was coming out at that time too, and that's what instantly makes this movie like worth seeing.
It's very different, like a lot of those movies were scattershot, like they were just kind of like set pieces,
kind of stumbled from set piece to set piece.
But, you know, I did find, like, at the end of this, I did feel like, you know, some of the things that happened, I did feel were somewhat realistic. So, yes, it was scattershot, but it also, I think, had a pretty good story at the base of it. You know, I mean, like, the first set piece I really dug. I mean, the one where they're, like, they pick up these girls in this, like, burger joint or whatever, and then they bring them back to his parents' house to like try and have sex with them, and it's just where they
convince them that they were going to give them cocaine.
Yeah, so they go and get like icing sugar or something.
Like they were snorting icing sugar because the girls didn't want to seem like they didn't know what they were doing. They were like, oh wow, I can feel it, it's working.
Yeah, so it's just one of those silly sex comedy scenes, but I still thought it was pretty fun. Anyway, I really recommend this movie, but I'd recommend not going and reading a bunch about it. Just check it out. Hard to find in the U.S. or in North America. You need a. Actually, I think it might have come
on MGM DVD, but I think it's like full frame. And
actually, I think it's set other company, Olive. Olive's put it out on Blu-ray, okay. But Olive doesn't have a lot of special features. So if you want the like good version of this, I'd recommend getting a region free player and buying it from Arrow, because they put out a pretty decent set, decent version of it. It's got a booklet with an article by past guest Robin Bucci, and it's got some interviews and stuff. So, and it was pretty good. I thought it was a good looking Blu-ray.
Yeah.
The soundtrack for this movie's really good as well. Really good of the use of the U2 song "I Will Follow," although kind of an oddly placed in the narrative. Journey's "Open Arms" plays a big role in this movie. The Gleaming Spheres "Are You Ready for the Sex Girls," which was also in "Revenge of the Nerds," yeah. I believe. The Waitresses, "I Know What Boys Like," The Police are in here, The Cars, Devo. So it's got a really good soundtrack.
It's probably got the best soundtrack outside of The Party Animal when it comes to these 80s.
Well, The Party Animal is an awesome Buzzcocks opening. Yeah. But it's got
a good soundtrack in general.
It just felt like one cool song after another. Although it does get a bit into kind of like it wasn't Lionel Richie. Who was it? Quincy Jones or something?
It's Quincy Jones.
It gets a little cheesy. My only complaint about the soundtrack is they reuse songs a few times.
Yeah.
Which I don't think I've ever seen that before.
Well, I think the reason is because there's no musical score for this movie whatsoever.
Right.
Like, it's just songs in the background playing the entire movie. They did not hire a composer for this movie. So if you watch the movie, you'll notice there's no music. It's just the songs they've licensed for the soundtrack.
Yeah. Really, anyway, it's a great, great flick. And
I'm glad I finally got to see it.
Yeah, I'm glad you did too.
It wasn't what I was expecting, but that's a good thing in this case.
Yeah. So check it out. That's The Last American Virgin.
And the only other thing I want to talk about Boaz Davidson before we move on here is that since he's made this movie, he's moved on to become one of the heads behind Millennium Films. So Millennium Films are a company who have produced a lot of stuff lately. Like, they made the Expendables movies, they made the latest Rambo movie. They just keep making movies that are playing theatrically that are fairly big name movies, and he's involved in all these. He's like a producer. He's like one of the heads of that studio. So it's cool that a guy's come from, you know, making these like sex comedies in Israel.
To he made X-Ray as well with Barbie Benton.
Yeah. And he's gone from like basically being an Israeli filmmaker making these sex comedies to working for Canon Films, and now like helping run a company that's making these fairly, you know, big name movies.
Yeah.
So that's cool.
Yeah, that's cool.
Okay. So that's that segment. Now let's talk about Jeffrey Combs and Barbara Crampton, shall we?
Okay.
So the thing I thought we could do is these two are mostly known for starring in movies together. Would you agree with that?
I'd say their biggest movies.
Their biggest movies are together.
It depends on what. With Combs, I think it depends a little bit more of where you're coming from.
Right.
But for horror fans, for sure.
Yeah. So I thought we could just talk about those movies first.
Okay.
And then we could just kind of go flip-flop on, you know, the two. Like, we'll talk about Jeffrey a little bit, then we'll talk a little bit about Barbara and stuff.
Okay.
So Jeffrey Combs was born in 1954 in California, and Barbara was born in 1958 in Long Island. As usual for these kind of actors, they started out, you know, getting their interest as younger kids and went into theater and all that before making a break into movies.
Yeah.
And the main movie that inspired us pairing them together is a 1985 movie called Reanimator.
Yes.
This is a movie that is produced by Charles Band and his Empire Pictures at the time. It's an adaptation of H.P. Lovecraft's story. And you really cannot walk into a room with horror fans without them knowing what Reanimator is.
No.
It's a movie that I just actually watched a couple days ago and I hadn't seen in a while. And it's a fun movie. Like, I don't know when the last time you saw it was.
Yeah, it's been a long time. Remember that special edition?
Oh, the Green Case Millennium Edition series or whatever?
Yeah.
So the basic of this movie is Jeffrey Combs plays a medical student called Herbert West.
Yeah.
And in the opening scene of the movie, he gets kicked out of this school in Switzerland because he gets caught like injecting something into his professor, and his professor's eyes proceed to pop out of his head and he melts down and dies.
Yeah.
So he ends up going to a university in America, and he's kind of becomes roommates with this guy played by Bruce Abbott, and Barbara plays Bruce's girlfriend, who also happens to be the dean's daughter.
Yeah.
And you know, Herbert's been playing with this formula called the reagent, which he uses to bring dead things back to life.
Yes.
So as you can imagine, this being a horror movie, you know, he's doing nefarious things in the background. His roommate becomes aware of this. His roommate's girlfriend becomes aware of this. The dean, because it's his daughter, becomes aware of this.
Yeah.
And then the main doctor, Dr. Hill, played by David Gale, also becomes aware of this, but he wants to use that to his advantage.
Yes.
So there's a lot of stuff in here where it's like talking about the mortality of humans and what it would be like to bring people back. But at the same time, it's like kind of a batshit zombie movie in a way, because, you know, he's like injecting this shit into cats to bring them back to life. He's injecting it into people, you know, and there's all this gore going on. Like in the end set pieces, people's intestines are wrapping around and trying to pull them into body cavities. You know, you got a decapitated head molesting a woman, you know, all kinds of stuff. It's a fucking crazy movie.
Yeah.
But this is the movie that defined Jeffrey Combs as an actor for.
Oh yeah. For
horror
sure.
People.
Yeah.
Because Herbert West is, you know, he's your basic run-of-the-mill nerd, really, if you think about it. Like, just a smart kind of guy who was always, like, scoffing at everyone else's work. You know, he outright insults Dr. Hill's work all the time.
And he's so good at it. Like, and Combs is so good.
He's great in this role.
Being like, that, like, asshole-y, I'm better than you kind
of. Yeah, because he's, like, a lot of times it's just shots of him just, like, kind of standing in the background just, like, with a smirk on his face.
Yeah.
You know, and just doing things like that, or just looking at someone and being like, don't you understand what I'm doing here?
Yeah.
Are you that stupid?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, he's kind of got that attitude to him the whole movie. And you know, this is the first time I ever saw him as an actor. And, you know, I'm just like, this guy's really good in this role. Like, there's something about him. And the thing is that he would actually play variations of this role throughout his career.
I know. He's even that way when I tried to get a picture taken with him.
Oh, what's that story?
I'm not going to tell that story.
I want to hear it.
No, I'm not going to tell that story. But I certainly
felt he was better than you?
He was better than me.
Yeah. All right.
So but he's still a legend.
He's played variations of this character through his career, but, you know, Herbert West, Reanimator, is always going to be the movie that he's known for.
Yeah.
Even though he's done, well, for us, maybe for sci-fi nerds, he would be known as, like, playing a character on Star Trek Deep Space Nine. And that character's clones, because he was on, like, 30-some episodes of that show, too.
Yeah, and Star Trek fans really love him.
Yeah, and he was under, like, heavy makeup, if I recall. I never watched Star Trek, so I'm not sure.
No, me neither.
But also in this movie, it's like, Barbara and him don't really kind of cross paths that much.
No.
But She's like a really, like, even though she wasn't born in California, I always had the impression that she was like just your basic California beauty, because she, you know, she had the blonde hair and, you know, she was very charismatic and seemed very kind of fun loving.
Right.
For the most part. So I always kind of equated her to being like one of those California beauties. And in this movie, she kind of is pushed to the side to be like, you know, the worrisome girlfriend.
Right.
But in that finale, man. Wow.
Yeah.
There's some stuff in that finale that you're just like, as an actress, I can't believe she read this script and was like, yeah, I'll do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure, why not?
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, it's like,
and the character she plays, just, it's so, like, not what you'd expect from even that character, right? Like,
yeah.
Because although, you know, Chris is saying, like, the blonde, you know, California girl, like,
but she's not,
she seemed
ditz.
Like a real nice girl,
yeah,
in this
she's
movie.
Not like a, yeah, ditz, like, yeah. she doesn't look like, feel like she'd belong in a movie like Valley Girl or something like,
yeah,
that, right?
Yeah,
like, she's like, you know, you think California blonde, you think dumb,
yeah,
whatever, but she is kind of girl next door, like you're saying.
Yeah, and super, and nice, and
this is kind of something, yeah, that would kind of carry over to some of her other movies.
Yeah,
you know, so Reanimator is a great movie. I think we can both agree on that.
Yeah.
But it's like, and they worked with Stuart Gordon, director Stuart Gordon, and this was really his breakthrough movie too.
Yeah.
You know, he would go on to make like Dolls for Charles Band, which I really love. And he would do another movie with these two called From Beyond a year later.
Yeah.
And this was another H.P. Lovecraft adaptation.
Yeah.
And I didn't like From Beyond as much.
Yeah, I've never been able to get behind From Beyond. I do want to pick up the Scream Factory disc just to see, give it one more shot.
So again, it's, you know, Combs playing kind of a scientist doctor-y type who's trying to find a way to like tap into the pineal gland of the brain so that you can become a better, more evolved human being. So kind of like Herbert West in a way.
Yeah.
And from what I remember, Barbara's character is like, I'm not sure what she's like, an assistant, I think it is.
I think so, yeah.
And she kind of gets pulled into this insanity. Really, the only thing I remember about From Beyond is she has a scene where she's wearing like full-on like dominatrix gear.
Yeah.
And, you know, that scene stuck with me since I saw it as a kid.
And I don't remember why she's in dominatrix gear.
I think it's because when they did the experiments, the pineal gland thing kind of like increased their sex drive really heavily.
Okay.
Because I remember like there was an older scientist type who worked with them who he kind of became this like deformed kind of creature that had this like, he melted half of his side. But he was like super horny and everything too. Like he was always trying to like get with her character.
Yeah.
And then like Jeffrey Combs, he eventually gets to the point where he's got a shaved head. He's got proboscis thing coming from the middle of his forehead, which looks like part of his brain. Like it's supposed to be like a brain stem or something, and it wiggles around. It's a weird movie. It's like I haven't seen it in a long time. I kind of want to see it again. But again, they were a good pair in this movie. Like they played off each other. They had more screen time together in this one. I felt like they played off each other really good in this one.
Yeah, they did.
And you know, again, Stuart Gordon directed it, and they paired up again.
Yeah.
And Stuart Gordon directed it.
Yeah.
And it was for Full Moon, and that's 1995's Castle Freak.
Right.
Which is another movie I actually think is underrated.
I remember being really excited about Castle Freak when it came out, because I think they were like kind of touting it as going to be really violent and extreme, and I remember being a little let down by it, but
I think the thing about Castle Freak is it came out like when Full Moon was starting to have struggles.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they had a video distribution deal with Paramount Pictures for a long time.
Okay.
And then when that kind of expired in, like, the early 90s, they kind of were struggling to get their stuff out there. And Castle Freak was kind of in that time frame where it kind of, like, didn't get to as many video stores as it probably should have. So, like, it took me a while to actually hunt this movie down when it first came out.
Well, I remember Full Moon at that time, they had their normal stuff. Then they had this, like, Torchlight.
Yeah, Torchlight.
It was, like, kind of the erotic movies.
Yeah, and then they had the kids one, too, Moonstone.
Moonstone. But they were supposed to have a line called Pulse Pounders that were going to come out. And I thought Castle Freak, if my memory serves me right, I thought Castle Freak was supposed to be like the first Pulse Pounders, and then Pulse Pounders never happened.
Yeah, they were also going to do like another Trancers movie and things like that.
Yeah, so it was, I just felt like, something weird about when it came out, and it just wasn't what I had hoped it would be.
I just remember having a hard time tracking it down.
Yeah.
And it's basically about this family who lives in this, who inherit this castle out in Italy.
Yeah.
And find out there's like a deformed monster living in the castle who's chained to the walls. And he wears like a bloody sheet over his face most of the time. And he has an appetite for prostitutes.
Yeah.
And so Barbara and Jeffrey in this one, they play like a married couple.
Yeah.
So this is them really getting to work with each other and play off each other. And again, I feel like they had really good chemistry together in all three of these movies. Like they played off each other really well.
Yeah.
And this is when I first started to really notice her as more of like a less of a sex object and more because she was. Like, let's be honest with each other.
See, I never thought of her as a sex
object. I always kind of did in the 80s, like right up till From Beyond.
Like in Reanimator, I didn't really think of her as a sex object.
Well, no, because it was kind of skeezy in Reanimator. But there's other movies I'm going to talk about
that
will concrete my opinion.
Oh, there's one movie where I definitely thought of her as a sex object. Okay.
Well, we'll get
anyway,
to that.
Anyway, she's not a sex object.
No. So, you know, I liked the fact that all three of these people worked together multiple times because you could see the growth in them working together. Yeah. Like, you could see them being more comfortable as actors and working together. And yeah. I thought that's really cool because, you know, back in the studio system days, you would see this. You would see, like, contract actors working with each other a lot. Whereas these days, it doesn't really happen that much. So, you know, it's kind of a bygone era, and I think it's cool that they got the chance to work with each other multiple times and grow with each other, because I feel like even though Combs was really good in Reanimator, he's continued to kind of on that path where he's been solid in everything I've seen him in.
Yeah.
Like, and we're going to talk about him now, so, and then we'll go back to her, to okay. Barbara here. So, like, I always found he's always played variations of Herbert West anyway through most of his career. But what I found interesting when I was looking into him was that he's actually done a lot of voice work too.
Yes,
like,
he has.
Like for animated shows and stuff. And
he's Ratchet, man. I had no idea. Transformers Prime.
Like, I had no freaking idea.
Yeah,
he was
me neither.
Working on like Transformer.
Well, I watched a whole bunch like of Transformers Prime, and I never thought Jeffrey Combs was doing one of the voices.
Really? Yeah, because is Ratchet the one who was like the telescope?
Who no, the he's frick like was the mechanic.
Was he the mechanic? Yeah, I guess Ratchet makes sense, right?
Yeah.
But I just remember, like, he has that look to him that he's always memorable, even when you see him.
Yeah,
because he's like kind of looks. I don't want to. I don't know what the word is. Weaselly, I guess, in a way. Like,
yeah,
he always looks like he's like got like scheming in movies.
That's a good word.
Like
for
he always
it.
Looks like he's trying to like twist everything to his advantage.
Yeah,
in every movie you see. Like I remember, he worked with like Full Moon a bunch, and Empire Pictures. You know, he did like Cellar Dweller.
Yeah.
Where he played like the cultist who like lived in this boarding house who unleashes the cellar dweller like in flashbacks,
right?
And then
not a big role though,
not a big role, but yeah. I still remember him in it.
Yeah,
I don't remember very much about Cellar Dweller, but I remember him.
Yeah, I also remember him in another small role early in his career was when the Fred Olen Ray Cyclone.
Yeah, and then he was also in Phantom Empire with that Fred Olen Ray directed. With Sybil Danning.
Oh, did Fred Ray direct that?
Yep.
Oh, interesting.
So he made a couple of them. But then in Full Moon, he also made him. I haven't seen the movie in a long time, so I can't verify what they played in the movie at all. But Barbara and him were also in Trancers 2 together.
Yep.
But I'm not sure if they shared scenes or anything because it's been an awfully long time.
Yeah, they weren't the stars of the movie.
Yeah, they were just like side characters. Yeah. I haven't seen that movie in so long, I couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
And then he did his version of Marvel's Doctor Strange when they made Dr. Mordred.
Yeah.
And I thought he was fun in that. Like, I thought he fit that role perfectly. You know, he was totally Doctor Strange, like right down to the fucking robe. Like, seriously, like that robe was, you could tell that's what they were riffing on
totally.
When you watched that movie. And I'd heard things about how, like, Charles Band tried to get Doctor Strange rights, but couldn't. So he just decided to make his own fucking movie that was so similar.
It's so obvious, especially now that Doctor Strange is
out.
Yeah,
like you're watching, you're like, it's so Doctor obvious. Strange. But I thought that was a fun movie. I thought he was good in it.
Well, that's one of the roles I think of with him.
Well, yeah, like apart from Herbert West, Dr. Mordred's probably his most well-known role to me anyway.
Yeah.
Like, you know, because he's the main character. He's a magician guy. He wears a flowing robe. He fights friggin' animatronic, like brought back to life dinosaur bones. He fights an evil sorcerer. It's a fun movie. Like, I really like Dr. Mordred. He also was in Lurking Fear for Full Moon, which is another H.P. Lovecraft adaptation. Not with Stuart Gordon. Not the greatest of movies, but I think he's like the... I think he's like the crazy priest in it or something
like
that.
He's another doctor in that.
Is he a doctor? Yeah. But I remember he's crazy.
Yeah.
He's like one of those over the top types. And then he was also in, Castle Freak, which we talked about.
Yeah.
But he's been in a lot of good stuff. The one I think of the most for him after Dr. Mordred and Reanimator, though, is The Frighteners.
Yeah.
Peter Jackson's movie.
Because he's also crazy in that.
I think the Frighteners gets a bum rap, man. I think it's like such a fun movie and nobody talks about it.
I liked it when it came out. I don't know how well it would hold up now.
I'm not sure how the visual effects might hold up now.
Yeah.
But it's a fun movie. It's like the last movie that, well, apart from Heavenly Creatures, it's the last movie Peter Jackson really made where I felt like he was, you know, someone I wanted to watch.
Right.
Because I'm not into the Lord of the Rings movies. And
no.
I'm definitely not into The Hobbit.
Right.
I feel like he needs to go back to stuff like this. Stuff that feels a little bit more personal for him.
I haven't really heard about what he's doing lately.
I don't think he's going to be able to really go back to this kind of thing now. Because, like, Lord of the Rings movies were, like, the most popular movies ever. And
yeah.
He's not going to be able to go back to that. But, so he was, like, a crazy doctor type in The Frighteners or whatever. And didn't he have, like, a Hitler mustache in it, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, I can't remember.
Yeah, he was kind of had this Hitler mustache, and he was just nuts. Yeah. When he plays crazy pretty damn good.
Yeah.
I got to admit. Another notable couple movies I have written down is another Stuart Gordon movie that I really love that has been, like, had a rough road on actually being available is a 1992 movie called Fortress, which we've talked about a little bit on our prison episode.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
With Christopher Lambert. He's one of the inmates that's fellow inmates of Christopher Lambert in it.
Yeah.
And he also reteamed with Brian Usna for a movie I have not seen called Faust, Love of the Dead. Yeah. Which looks like it's a gothic-y monster movie.
Yeah.
I don't know. Have you seen it?
Haven't seen it. No, okay, it's one of those ones that I'm just not interested in. But
yeah, I can't really talk much about that. He also showed up in House on Haunted Hill.
Yeah.
And he's in the Ricky Bates movie Suburban Gothic.
Right.
Which I'm looking forward to seeing because I really liked Excision.
Have you even seen that one yet?
No.
Okay.
But I really liked Excision. But, like, he's just one of those guys. He's like, I feel like when I told people who we were doing for this, like, I told a couple of people, like, oh, we're doing Jeffrey Combs and Barbara Crampton. They were just gave me those looks like, who?
Hmm.
Because I feel like people like us who are into cult movies totally will appreciate both of these performers. And, you know, if he's got a fan base, he's got a niche audience, so be it. I mean, he deserves it.
Yeah.
I feel like he's, Herbert West is definitely his defining character, but he's always managed to be the scene stealer in almost every movie I've seen him in.
Totally.
Like, he's the guy you usually remember in these movies.
And yeah.
I don't know if it's just because of his mannerisms or what it is, but he always seems to bring that, what I said, that, like, I'm always got something else going on under the surface that you're not seeing. And I think,
well, he's also just one of these guys that's probably, like, one of the more trained and talented actors that are showing up in some of these movies. So, of course, when they're, like, coming on the screen, they're dominating.
Right.
Because, you know, I feel like Combs really does know what he's doing. And, you know, a lot of actors, let's be honest, in B-movies don't really know what they're doing.
Have you seen latest Full Moon movies? You can tell.
Yeah. So he can just walk in and just dominate the whole thing. But he's been doing that from the beginning.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, the second you see Herbert West, he owns the character. And he's been back in two more of them when he's really made that for himself. A couple of other titles that you didn't list that I wanted to bring up that I thought he really stood out in. One's from a movie called Love in a 45.
Yeah, I haven't seen that in so long that I can't.
Yeah, that's why I mean, I didn't Combs really, he plays like a mobster, like, kind of thug. It's like him and this other guy are, like, kind of after the main characters for the movie. And this is a movie, I can't remember what year that movie was made.
94, I think.
Yeah, 94. It was a total, like, Tarantino ripoff, and a lot of people were kind of down on it, but I've always kind of had a bit of a soft spot for it. It stars Jill Bellows and Renee Zellweger as this kind of, like, Bonnie and Clyde type for the 90s on the run, and they have this other person with them, played by Rory Cochrane, who's, like, this bald kind of bad dude. And but I remember there was this one scene with Combs where Rory Cochrane's, like, strapped to a chair in a tattoo parlor, and the two the two henchmen, one of whom is played by Jeffrey Combs as Dinosaur Bob, are like torturing Rory Cochran with the tattoo gun by like sort of ramming it into his head. So that's a scene that really sort of sticks out for me when I think of Jeffrey Combs. And another like classic role by this guy in a movie that no one's seen is a movie called Caught Up, which I have brought up a few times, directed by Darren Scott and starring Bokeem Woodbine. And
I didn't know he was in that.
It's a great fucking movie, man. But he plays this like security guard, and that spoiler alert, but I just have to bring this up. But if you don't want to hear about it, don't listen for the next 20 seconds, but I'm gonna bring it up because I think people need to see this movie. So Combs's character ends up getting his there's a bit of a reveal in this where he reveals that he's so insane because he's had his cock shot off and he proceeds to pull down his pants to a full frontal shot of him wearing one of like a piss bag with a tube going to his like junk. And he's like deranged because Bokeem Woodbine's friend shot his dick off. But like, these are the types of roles that Combs would do and be able to pull off without being completely ridiculous, and make them memorable because he's Jeffrey Combs. But, that's one of the, like the roles I really think of him with, and probably unfortunately for him, but, I just think it's pretty funny that he like does roles like this in addition to playing Herbert West, because the role he plays in Love in a 45 is nothing like Herbert West. Like, he's kind of a badass in that movie.
I think it's funny that he's playing these kind of like eccentric roles too, because like, you know, from all I can tell, he's a pretty serious actor too. Yeah. Like, you know, he was
seeing him with that piss bag is hilarious.
He was recently playing Edgar Allan Poe on stage, you know, and
in like a one man show.
Yeah, it's like he's classically trained, I believe.
Yeah,
but he's in these B movies with the like, piss bags strapped to him and like you know, bringing people back with reagent and stuff. It's just like it's a weird trajectory, but I'm happy he chose this trajectory because he's made a lot of memorable characters in a lot of these horror movies and B movies that we like.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to quickly mention that I actually really do dig the Reanimator sequels too. I feel like his character was a little bit diluted in the second one, but in the third one he just got to go for it, and I really appreciated that.
I've never seen the third one.
Yeah, he goes for it in the third one. I think that I like the third one much better than Bride.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh wow.
The third one's just got something about it because it's Herbert West in prison, man.
I know.
It's like, how can you go wrong? He decides he wants to like use the reagent on prisoners. How can you go wrong with that? So that's Jeffrey. Should we talk a little bit about Barbara now?
Yeah.
Okay. So now the thing I think funny about her is that she was such a regular on soap operas over the years.
Yeah.
Like she's been on Young and the Restless, Bold and Beautiful, Guiding Light. So she's in these like soap operas, which admittedly are not like the most highbrow entertainment in the world, but when you're balancing that with a movie like Reanimator and a movie like Chopping Mall, you know, kind of weird.
Exactly.
But going back to the thing about saying that she was a sex symbol for me in the 80s, it's movies like Chopping Mall.
Yeah.
You know, it's movies like Fraternity Vacation. You know, so in Chopping Mall, she is the one who gets naked.
One of the ones, yes.
One of the ones, you know. It's a cheesy B movie about killer robots in a mall.
Yeah.
It's great. It's fun. It's Jim Wynorski.
She's super annoying in that movie, though. I mean, yeah, that's the role, but...
yeah, she is kind of one note in it.
She's the whining, you know, the whining one that's like hysterical, like once the shit starts hitting the fan, she's the one that goes hysterical and makes all the stupid decisions.
Yeah, it's true. But I didn't think she was that bad in it. But
she's not bad, but her character is
she
terrible.
Just has that scene in it, you know, the topless scene where you're like, okay, I've seen her do this before. Yeah. That's why she's kind of a... I was growing up in that time. I was, you know, I'm going through puberty at time. She's taking her top off a lot for me. I'm happy about that, you know?
Yeah.
Same thing with Fraternity Vacation. Very small role. And I think this might be the reason why I equate her to California Girls. Because this is like a beach movie. So it's a TNA movie where they go you know, to the I think it's Fort Lauderdale or somewhere like that to get laid. Mm. And she plays one of these two girls who come into the hotel room and is like, oh, she's kind of ditzy, but she, like, her and the other girl take their tops off.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, let's, you know, you want to make out kind of thing. But she's got the crimped hair and she's kind of ditzy. So I think that's might be why I equated her with that. But the interesting thing about that is the other girl who's her friend is played by Kathleen Kinnaman.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Who played Bride of Reanimator.
Yeah, that's funny.
So I found that to be kind of amusing when I was looking into it.
Yeah.
Fraternity Vacation's a pretty fun movie, too.
Yeah.
I you said you haven't seen it.
No, it's one of those ones that's just eluded me.
But it's a fun movie. It's like Stephen Jeffries from Fright Night.
Yeah.
Who plays the main character, who's like the nerdy guy who his friends have to get him laid. You know, typical plotting.
Yeah.
And she's not in it that much, but she's memorable because there's a lot of really, like, you know, very nice-looking women and girls in this movie in bikinis and everything. And she stands out because not only is she like hot in this movie, she's also funny.
Yeah.
Like she showed that she had a knack for comedy in this movie because she's not in it very much, but you remember her scenes.
Yeah.
Just because she brings her character is a stereotypical character, but she's doing it so well that you're just like, you feel like she's dumb in real life and you know that's not the case.
Right.
You know, it's perfect. It's the way she did it.
While we're on the subject of cramped and nude scenes.
Okay.
I have to bring up, because I know a lot of people of my age will remember a very, very short scene she had in the movie Body Double.
Yep. Yep.
Playing Craig Wasson's cheating wife. But she's only in it for like literally like 10 seconds or something. But it's a very, very memorable 10 seconds as he's catching her in the act.
Right.
But yes, that was Barbara Crampton as well. And I think that was her film debut. But yeah, she certainly made an impression.
I think it was. And then she was the same thing, just like Jeffrey. Had a little run with Full Moon. She, I remember her appearing as like a girl who goes to the psychic with her boyfriend in Puppet Master, the original Puppet Master, yeah. At the traveling sideshow. She was in Transfers 2, like I said, and she was also in Robot Wars, which is the really low-budget sequel to Robot Jocks.
Right.
I don't really remember much about that movie, to be honest, but she was in that. And she also reteamed with Stuart Gordon for Space Truckers.
Yeah.
Which I did not remember.
Did you remember that she was in it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't really remember that movie.
Yeah, it's a pretty weird little movie. Like, Dennis Hopper is an intergalactic trucker.
Yeah.
It's like Convoy in Outer Space. It's a really strange little movie. I just bought the DVD.
Did you?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I bought it because I wanted to revisit it. So yeah. We'll see how that turns out. Maybe I'll watch it after I watch Children of Corn 2.
Have you ever seen this movie Kidnapped she was in?
No.
With David Naughton?
No, what's that?
I don't know. Like I've never seen it, but it was early in her career. It was in 1987, but it sounds like it's something to do with like her sister or her friend, and they get involved in like porn movies, and she teams up with I think David Naughton to like try and rescue her friend from the porn industry or something.
Is this like a TV movie?
Never heard of it in my life. No, it's not a TV movie.
Really?
Yeah. So huh. I'm going to be seeking that one out too because I've never heard of that.
But then it's like kind of I remember she kind of faded away though after that, like in the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, I think she was doing some soap work and yeah. She had the occasional thing, but well, really, there was almost 20 years there that went by without her really doing much.
Yeah, because she was on a lot of episodes of Bold and the Beautiful. She was on like over 100 episodes of that alone.
Yeah.
So she's probably busy with that. But then it was a movie called You're Next.
Yeah.
Which brought her back into kind of the horror limelight.
And I didn't even recognize her in this.
No, she played like the matriarch of a big family getting together for a
reunion.
You know, a reunion dinner. And you know, when I watched the movie, I didn't really even think it was her. Like,
no.
It didn't pass my brain. And then the end credits came on. I'm like, I saw the name. I'm like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
And then I had to go back. And I think that's like kind of an interesting career arc in a way.
Yeah.
Because she started out for me being like the sexy girl in movies, and then she was kind of, she was like solid as that, and then she kind of, like you said in Reanimator, and that she did show that she, her character had smarts too, so it wasn't like, you know, it was kind of balanced. But then
I never really thought of her really as a sex symbol, like, you know, we've talked about this already, but like I just never really, but at the same time now, like, with starting with Your Next, completely different.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. Yeah. Like, it's from here, it's like she kind of became like this, started delivering stuff that I really hate to say it, but I was surprised by these roles. Like, you know, she was in Lords of Salem in a role, right?
I don't remember her in Lords of Salem. I don't know who she was in there.
Yeah, so she was probably...
I know she's in it, but
it's probably just that thing with Rob Zombie where he kind of throws everybody into the movie.
Yeah, I couldn't place her,
But... the movie I want to talk about that really made me open my eyes to her as a really solid and good actress is a movie called We Are Still Here that we both really liked.
Yeah, that was on my top five last year.
Like,
yeah,
she's, I really found her to be a revelation in this movie.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this was her, a horror movie at its heart, but she was so, her character in this movie was just so serious and so damaged in this movie.
Yeah.
And I wasn't expecting that from her.
Yeah.
You know, like, because being a B-movie and horror fan, you know, I'm just used to the Barbara Crampton where she's like, you know, being pursued by people and taking her top off her, you know, stuff like that. I wasn't expecting this seeing her playing this woman who's damaged by the loss of a child, you know, who's isolated and depressed and all those things. And I wasn't expecting that. And I really feel that that's a great thing that she's managed to come back from this hiatus and show that to people, like, you know, I'm an actress and this is what I do. And, you know, and to do it in such a convincing way in like a low budget Fulci inspired horror movie like that.
Well, I think she's really also, like, really, you know, being a little bit of a trailblazer for, like, young actresses nowadays, too. Because, you know, you always are hearing that there's no roles for women over 40 and stuff like that. And I think she's just knocking it out of the park lately.
She's been busy.
Because she's been picking really good roles, and she's been delivering awesome performances and really showing that, you know, for, you know, someone who, like, I'm, you know, not pointing fingers, and I'm really not pointing fingers, but just as an example, like someone like Linnea Quigley or something, you know, who have just sort of went like, well, I'm just, I'm, you know, I've, my time's passed, and I'll just take anything just to, you know, but Barbara Crampton's able to like be like, no, I'm going to take roles I really want to do and take things that are interesting and really show and really explore my training as an actress and act, you know, instead of just, you know, and I think she's almost not doing, kind of enjoying that.
She's not doing this Tiffany Shepish, you pay me lunch, I'll be in your movie thing.
Exactly. Like, I think it's a real inspiration for, like, you know, quote unquote scream queens, that they can see that someone can go out there at her age, you know, and she's not that old, but she's older, and be able to, you know, choose really good roles and work with really cool directors and be in really cool movies.
Well, and I also think that a lot of that has to do with just the appreciation of her as an actress.
Yeah.
Because all these people who are making the movies now grew up watching her stuff. So they're remembering, you know, that and saying, okay, we need someone who's a more mature female character in this movie. Who can we go to?
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think she has been really smart about what she's been picking to be in. And, you know, like you said, she's not just being like a Felissa Rose kind of thing where, like, I'm having a resurgence, I'll be in anything.
And I think by doing that, by choosing that path, she has kind of become the go-to. And I think a lot of them have the ability to do that, but I just don't think a lot of them maybe even think it's possible. But this is a real inspiration to all these like women in not just even in B movies. I mean, it's a common complaint, but I mean, she was so good in We Are Still Here.
Yep.
She wasn't in Your Next a lot, but, you know, she was fine.
She was solid in Your Next, yeah.
Now, I watched a movie that she's been in recently called Sunchoke that she is also absolutely fantastic in. This is 2015 movie, but it was released this year, directed by Ben Kressman, and this is more of a character study of a kind of damaged young woman, but Crampton plays a kind of caregiver to the young woman. Like, she's like the young woman's father's housekeeper, I believe, and she's taking care of this young woman, trying to sort of nurse her back, but at the same time she's quite threatening. It's again, like, awesome role. And I think it's telling that between We Are Still Here and this movie, Crampton's probably been in a movie that's going to make my top five for 2 years in a row, you know. And I think that's really, really great. She picked another movie called Beyond the Gates that's coming out, and that's, you know, another movie that's getting a lot of buzz right now. And it's the premise is it's one of those old, like, VCR style video games, and then it turns into a horror movie. But I guarantee you that she's not going to be some stupid character in this. I mean, I'm sure she's got a lot to offer. Same with Tales from Halloween. I mean, she's got a role in that as well. But I think she's picking really good movies that are getting buzz. And I think she's making some really, really excellent choices. And I think other people should be looking at her career as something to aspire to.
Yeah, and she's got another movie coming out that I just want to mention real quick called Death House.
Okay.
It's coming out next year. And the reason I want to mention this is because it's kind of like a greatest hits movie for horror cult fans. Because it's just the cast of this movie, dude. And I know they're probably not going to be in it a lot. But look at the names who are in this movie. We've got Barbara Crampton, Adrian Barbeau.
Yeah.
Bill Moseley, Michael Berryman, Dee Wallace, Tony Todd, Sid Haig, Kane Hodder, Lloyd Kaufman, Debbie Rochon, Tiffany Shepis, Felicia Rose, Camille Keaton, among others. Brink Stevens. Like a hit list of people I grew up watching their movies.
Interesting. Yeah.
I don't know how it's going to work out, because that's an awful lot of people to have in this movie. So I feel like they're just going to have one scene and done.
Yeah, it kind of almost makes me sort of disappointed, actually. But I mean...
Disappointed in what way?
Well, just like, I just... That seems like a role like I would rather her not be taking, but...
Well, that's true in a way, but it's like... It's kind of showing that she has become this kind of cult royalty, though.
Yes, for sure, yeah.
Which I think is deserved.
Yeah.
Because it's like I said, I might have grown up looking at her as being like this... for me, a sex symbol.
Yeah.
But I've learned to appreciate her over time as an actual actress, you know, not just from these movies that she's doing now, which are really great choices and really wise movies. I can look back at this past work and say, okay, there was stuff that I wasn't picking up on when I was young that I'm picking up on now. And I can see the subtleties of this. And you know, she's really good in these movies. Like, even these silly movies like Fraternity Vacation, like I said, she's really good in it because she's playing that stereotype really well. And, you know, she's good at doing it. Like, she's funny in that movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's really, like you said, a very, to have a career that long, even though there was a gap in it, and be able to come back so strong is definitely something that, like you said, these people should be looking at, like Linnea and all them.
Well, she's hitting her stride in her mid-50s, for God's sake.
I know, it's possible.
It's possible.
You know, people aren't going to forget you. Her contributions that she did in the past obviously carried over to present time and got her these jobs.
Yeah, I mean, I think she's, between the two of them, I think she's just rocking it right now.
Like if she can continue to do roles like We Are Still Here, which impressed the living hell out of me.
And Sunchoke, yeah.
I haven't seen that, so I can't see.
Yeah, but check it out. It's on Netflix.
But she really impressed the hell out of me in that movie. Yeah. So if she can continue being that solid, I mean, I can understand why she'd be a go-to. She's really good in that movie.
Yeah, she's great. And both those movies completely stands out. So and owns the movie in both cases. So, yeah.
And now, as for Jeffrey, there's only one thing I want him to do.
What's that?
I want him to make that actual movie with Brian Usna, the 4-3 animator movie, where Herbert West becomes president.
Oh,
that's what I want.
That sounds like Billy Jack becoming president. Oh.
I know, but I just think it would be ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I'd like to see that. I really would have thought it'd be cool if I lived in LA and would have got a chance to see him doing Poe, though.
Yeah.
But he's another guy. He's managed to take one iconic performance and spin it into a career. And, you know, he's always the most memorable thing in almost everything he's in. So
it's true.
It's great.
All right. Well, that wraps up Cramp Calm.
What? Cramp Calm? Comb Cramp? I got a comb cramp.
So do you have a favorite Combs role?
Well, it's Herbert West. That's obvious. But like I said, I really like him in Frighteners.
Yeah.
I think he's really fun in Frighteners.
Yeah.
And as for Barbara, obviously for me, it's We Are Still Here. I think if you want to see someone at the top of their game, that's the movie to watch.
We Are Still Here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens. I mean, these are actors who are starting to get a little bit older, and you know, I'm glad they're appreciated and can continue grabbing these roles. So hopefully there's good things in the future for both of them.
Yeah.
So that's our Crampton Combs talk. And should I do my spiel here?
Sure.
So if you want to connect with us, which Josh is laughing about, everything you need to know, including Twitter, Facebook, and iTunes, is at www.thevideograveyard.com/GBW podcast. Really would love it if you went and rated us and reviewed us on iTunes, because the more of those we get, the more featured we get. So on and so forth, yada, 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 yada. Why? Well, you're laughing at me.
Well, makes why it hard. Even bother?
Why do I bother?
No, anyway. I mean, seriously. Okay, anyway.
Anyway.
Thanks so much for
thanks going. Thanks for listening. And until next time, I'm Josh. Or I'm Chris.
No, I'm Josh.
And that's Josh. I was acting like our two subjects.
Okay.
We'll see you next time.
Bye.